So tonight, we are going to talk about the last faculty, which is wisdom. It seems kind of like this is like the end, but in reality, this is the beginning. It's kind of a strange thing that way, that we go through all these faculties, get to wisdom, and as we're going to see, wisdom is the thing that propels all the other faculties into play again. So this talk has both the ending resolve, but it also has this uplifting kind of energy that we start again. But to kind of start with this wisdom start, of course, when I first came into the practice, I can't believe how much it felt like there was just so much stuff to learn. Just this almost like you're studying, learning. And, you know, every talk I would go to, every non-residential, it didn't matter. Christina Feldman, Norman Fisher, it didn't matter. I had to have these notes, pads, taking notes, learning. Sort of like this practice was going to teach me something. I was going to get something, learn something, know something. And from the way that we are taught, from the time we're kids, wisdom comes with this kind of knowing, this learning process. And that's what at least for me, that's what I brought into the practice. You know, spending all those years in school, that's all I knew. Was I'll just learn this and then it'll be okay. Then I'll have it. You know, I'll know that and then I could use it whenever. But that is not the way it works. In fact, Bhikkhu Bodhi said, intellectually learning Buddhist teaching will not bring you any closer to wisdom. Buddhist teachings harness the pre-existing capacity of the mind towards the realization of the unconditioned. So sometimes when Bhikkhu Bodhi, I read things of his, I have to take a moment, say, what? What I think he's saying is that the wisdom that we're going to talk about tonight is not what you know, it's what you embody, it's what you feel, it's what you realize. That, not what you know. You may not know anything. It may feel like, oh, I can't tell you which list is what. I can't remember any of these terms, and I can't remember half of what I think some teacher said at some point. But there's some knowing that's going on in the body. There's a knowing that's happening within me the longer I stay in this practice. No matter whether you ever leave a room with any notes, there's a knowing that's happening. And that's the wisdom that I want to talk about. It's not the kind of wisdom that makes us smarter. In fact, most of my family, if I've been doing this practice for like 25 years now, and most of my family will say, I don't know why she does that. It's just, she's the same. There's no difference. There's that sense that I didn't change, but I feel so different on the inside. I know that there's a difference in me on the inside. I could not articulate it to them because when I get around them and we're together, we all act the same way. I'm still the same sister they've always had, but there's a difference. What they would probably say is, well, she's probably calmer. She's probably not quite so mean as she used to be. They might say that. But they wouldn't think of it as me being wiser or me having some wisdom. But I know inside that there's a wisdom there that over these many years has grown deeper and deeper and deeper. So this wisdom Pema Chodron, she says meditation, but I'm going to say practice. This practice is a process of lightening up, of trusting the basic goodness of what we have and who we are, and of realizing that any wisdom that exists, exists in what we already have. We can lead our life so as to become more awake to who we are and what we are doing, rather than trying to improve or change or get rid of what we are or what we're doing. The key is to wake up to becoming more alert, more inquisitive, and curious about ourselves. That there's something in just you, just me, knowing me, is it. That is kind of a strange concept, though, isn't it? That if the only thing this practice was ever pointing to, out of all of the stuff that we have listened to, talked to, heard, all the retreats, all the practice, if it was all about just getting to know oneself, without all the judgment, without all the rules, limitations, just getting to know oneself, that would be something. That would be something very different. Because in everything, especially in the West, that we do, is about getting away from ourselves. Everything we buy, everything about our lives is about what can I go out away from me so I can be somebody else, somebody better, who's much better than me. If I could be that, then I would be okay. I'd be smarter, wiser, kinder. But this practice is about the journey inward, deeper and deeper and deeper into knowing oneself. The more you know yourself, more wisdom you have. It's a different kind of wisdom. It doesn't come from doing something. In fact, it comes from not doing anything. It comes from just simply being awake in your ordinary life. Somehow, could we just be content? And what would that look like? So I'd like to talk about wisdom from three perspectives. One is contemplation. There's a place in this wisdom, contemplation, that we need this contemplation aspect to connect with this wisdom. So I want to talk about this wisdom from contemplation. There is a necessary realization that comes with this wisdom, this getting to know oneself. So I want to talk about it from the realizations that arise. And then lastly, from this discernment, because this wisdom creates this capacity to respond to life through discernment and not so much from this reactivity in life and this impulsive nature of our human instincts. So to start here with contemplation. Let me just one more thing from Ajahn Chah before I leave. This idea of where we're going to get this information from. It's not going to come from out there. It's not going to come from me, even though I'm the one doing the talking. It's not me, Tuere, that has this wisdom. There's a place deep within me that resides in all of us. That's where it comes from. So even though I listen outside, when I am generating or connecting to wisdom, it's not coming from outside. Ajahn Chah said, "You are your own teacher. Looking for teachers can't solve your own doubt. Investigate yourself to find the truth, inside, not outside. Knowing yourself is most important." So that's what we're going to try to do, try to turn inward. And in order for us to turn inward, we have to be still. That's like strange to me for somebody who had so much panic and anxiety that I would recognize that in order for me to access this wisdom comes from stillness. It comes from being able to see the way things truly are. But we cannot see the way things truly are until we be still. It is unavoidable, this stillness, in being able to see. So wisdom would be seeing the three characteristics of life. It's seeing the impermanence of things, of phenomena, existence. It's seeing the dissatisfaction with everything, that edge of wanting to correct everything, and seeing our delusion in not seeing what's actually happening around us. It's in that seeing. And I think when I first started practicing, I thought that if I knew the three characteristics, okay, that's okay, it's impermanence, it's dissatisfaction, it's delusion. I know that. I know it. I almost like spent hours trying to memorize lists so I could no. But that is not it. Because I could quote that list day in and day out, but it will not help you see or help you stop getting bummed out every time something changes. Every time something goes wrong, it's like, oh man, it's all this energy of I don't like that, that resentment, that wanting my own way, and if it doesn't happen, then I'm all mad and irritated. And I'm trying to work with my anger so I won't be so mad, so I'll sound nice. I've missed it. Just in that capacity, even though I knew what the three characteristics were, and even though I knew that the first noble truth is that there is suffering, I could know that. But in the midst of something not going my way, I could not feel my own grasping. I could not tell you that I was clinging to something. I couldn't see the greed, I couldn't see the anger, I wouldn't know that it was there. I would just try to get over this disappointment. So in this contemplation, in this stillness, you can begin to see something a little different. I don't know if you guys have seen this, but the first time I saw that I was thinking and not sitting was a little embarrassing because I was thinking about something really, really bad from my childhood. And I was sitting at this retreat and I'm crying, I'm so upset. To the core, I'm upset. And I think Rodney had tried all retreat to help me, but I'm so distraught and I'm trapped in all of this sadness. And I will never forget the moment when I was sitting there and then it's like mine woke up. And I realized I was sitting in a retreat hall, very beautiful, like here, very peaceful. Nothing's happening. It was all still and quiet. And I was so happy to be on this retreat because it was special. And then I was back to, oh, I can't believe this is happening to me. And I was so distraught. And then this moment when I'm like, still. And I had this realization that I was thinking. And it's not like, I mean, I know it sounds strange because we think all the time, but that's the point. We think all the time. And I didn't realize how much my mood or my attitude was based on thinking and not on reality. Reality, very peaceful, very wonderful place I was sitting in. But then I was sitting in this wonderful place crying because I was thinking about something that happened, I won't say how long ago. Let's just say it was several years ago. That thinking was this sort of freeing moment. It was this liberating moment when I realized that my suffering, my pain, was not coming from anything that was happening to me. It was coming from a thought. But what made it so dramatic for me is because I was sitting in a place of stillness and silence. I could have had that same kind of memory, and I may have had that same similar memory sitting, you know, doing something at work, and all of a sudden I have this insight that, oh, that's I'm thinking. But it didn't have the dramatic thing as it did when I realized I wasn't moving. I was not doing anything to generate anything. No sadness, no nothing. And yet I'm caught and trapped in this mind state. Joseph Goldstein once said that every time we become aware of a thought, as opposed to being lost in a thought, we experience that opening of the mind. It was in that awakened opening of the mind that I realized I was thinking. First time I ever noticed the difference between being sleepy, thinking, I just cannot sit another moment. I need to just get up because I'm so tired. First time I realized that there was a part of me that was not sleepy. In the middle of this long sit, I'm not sleepy. I connected to something else. And that the sleepiness was just some mind state, like thinking. It is a strange phenomenon because I cannot make myself realize I'm not sleepy in the middle of a sit. Something happens. It's kind of a looking for it. It's a looking, a trusting in whether or not you're actually sleepy. It's not believing what you necessarily see or hear just because you think this is what it is. It's having a little bit of speculation, little curiosity. I'm not really sure this is it. And something about that capacity to question into what's actually happening brings this kind of awareness, insight, understanding. And that insight, understanding, awareness begins to show itself when we're still and we're quiet. When we're still and we're not trying to do something, we kind of begin to see some things. Here's something else from Joseph Goldstein. Just as the light of a candle, single candle, can dispel the darkness of 1,000 years, one single candle could dispel darkness of 1,000 years. The moment we light a single candle of wisdom, no matter how long or deep our confusion, ignorance is dispelled. The ignorance doesn't get dispelled from us. The ignorance gets dispelled from wisdom. And wisdom comes from being still and waiting. One way to think of this kind of being still is that we are moving constantly, moving thoughts, moving bodies, moving. Stuff is moving around us. There's all this sort of movement going on all around us. And we have to almost wait for the mind to catch up with our body. For anybody that goes to Capitol Hill, they would know that I have a difficult time with silence. I'm working on it. But so if I do a talk and then I say, okay, so there we talk a little and I talk a little and then we have discussion. So I'll talk a little and then we open it up for discussion. I have like probably a 10-second rule. But if someone doesn't talk in like 10 seconds, then I'm gonna start talking again. And so people in the group have learned to just get me to just wait. Let people get their thoughts together. So I sit in this kind of wanting to say something, but wait. Learning to wait and give people time to talk. Or even when we do these little small groups, there's all this energy in me that says, okay, I'm going to say mine and get it out of the way. And then I have to wait. And some people take their time, gather their thoughts, and then speak into that, right? That's what you're doing with the mind. You are not trying to rush the mind. You just be still and wait. And you let the mind unwind from all the moving that's happening. A lot of moving going on. So the mind has to unwind, like throwing a pebble into still waters. The ripples are gonna go. And you gotta wait for all those ripples to unwind themselves, unripple, stop moving. And then the water becomes still again. If you try to smooth out the water so it'll be still, you're just making more ripples in the water. So what we're trying to do is be still even with the movement that's going on in the head to give the mind time to be quiet. When the mind settles down, then this contemplative place that we've put ourselves in, something begins to arise. One more thing about this stillness, though. It's a visceral level of stillness. It is a not needing to move anymore. It's in a not needing to fix anything. Sort of like, could we give ourselves permission to not have to fix nothing, not have to plan anything? I don't have to be responsible for what's going on in the kitchen. I don't have to worry about other people, who's sitting over there, who's doing that. It's kind of a visceral in the body settling down, not moving. And we work with that by stilling the grossness of the body, being still, and then letting that gross body stillness begin to have this leveling off on a visceral level. Less and less and less care that we have to worry about everybody else and everything else. All the movement we do will not get us to that visceral state of stillness. It is going to come with just being still. So this being still means being still with anything. Whatever comes up, whatever arises in the moment, just going to be still. You're going to be still not because you know what's going to happen, not because you know necessarily what to do, not because it's like, oh yes, if I do this, then this, then this, then this. It's not that. You be still because you're waiting to see what will arise in this moment. You're waiting to see what does irritation say? What does it mean? What is that? You're being still with whatever is arising so you can see it more clearly what it is. Some of you guys know I am addicted to solitaire on my phone. And I have tried to let it go, but now I have decided this will be my practice. Solitaire is going to help me still the mind. And so the way I have decided to start practicing with this is that I play, and I play impulsively. So I'm going to play this game, and I'm going to play just whatever the impulse is to do. The way I used to play solitaire, I probably should clarify, is I used to cheat. So if I saw that what I had done was wrong, wasn't going to work, I would undo all the way back till I fixed what that problem was. And then I would win and be like, yay! So now I play impulsively, right? So just the impulse of whatever I'm thinking, I just do it. And then when I don't win, I notice that. I hated not winning, and I hated not noticing that I didn't win. So I'd always want to go back and fix it. And now I just notice this not winning. What is it about the not winning that makes something feel wrong? Like I did something wrong. I didn't do it right. What is that? So I spend some time with it. If I'm going to play solitaire, I might as well find some means of practice in this. And losing is a big deal. So I try to see the losing. And inevitably, I have begun to see how my impulsive decisions without stillness and thought before I make some move with the card, how that impulsive behavior ultimately has some effect on me. It has an effect on the game. Since I do it so much, that's where I look for practice, in this place that's my ordinary life. Ajahn Chah said that the peace which arises from wisdom is not happiness, but it is that which sees the truth of both happiness and unhappiness. For so long in my practice, I spent trying to find happiness, trying to find some good quality, some blissfulness, which is how we're going to move here to realization. Because most everything I did in practice was about somehow or another connecting with a blissful state. And I would go to retreats and I would feel so happy, so free, so open. I loved everything and everybody. And for a person that has an averse kind of personality, always angry and grumbling all the time, love is a beautiful thing. So I'm at these retreats and I love everybody and I'm happy and everything's nice, nothing's going wrong. And I thought that that was wisdom. So for a long time, every time I would go to a retreat, every time I would be at a day long, it didn't matter, non-residential, I was searching for this kind of blissful, happy state that I could know that I was getting wise, because how else would I get wise if I wasn't blissful and happy? Because, you know, if you are not mad and you are happy, then life is good. That's it. That's at the whole point. But when we start moving into the second and the third truth, into this realization, the second and third noble truth, you start beginning to see just how much we get in the way, just how difficult we make life. And so going to these retreats had this experience of I felt all of this happiness, joy. And you can see that it's easy for me to get tripped up in this. And I think a lot of us get tripped up in this place. Because when we go home, we do everything we can to hold on to that peacefulness, walk around in kindness and love and joy. But it doesn't stay. And I think for many years, I thought that the higher consciousness was so connected to wisdom that when I lost the higher consciousness, I would lose my wisdom. That wisdom is connected to these higher states. I just don't know why we fall for that con every time. I don't know why we get caught in that, because it's not long after the retreat that we almost get worse than we were before we left. I remember going to a retreat one time, it was so beautiful, it was not with Rodney, and when I got home, I don't even think I was in Seattle very long before. This was at Cloud Mountain too. I think the couple hours ride trip from Cloud Mountain to Seattle, everything was gone. And by the time I got home, I was so irritated. It's like I would be gone for a week, so my family would say, oh, let's get together for the big coming back home from the retreat thing. So I would drive from the retreat to my sister's house. 20 minutes into it, we could barely stay in the same room together. And she would ask me, like, what happened? I thought you went on the retreat to get more peaceful. Like, I thought so too. I don't know what happened. I had it, and then I lost it. Somehow, if I had held on to that peacefulness, I would still have it. There was this sense that wisdom is connected to that bliss, that higher consciousness that we can get to when we sit. So I sent Rodney an email. Thank God for Rodney. And I said, I don't know what happened. I had it and then I lost it. He said, really, Tori? I said, I don't understand why that happened. Well, you know, what should I have done? And he asked me to just wait. Don't do anything, don't judge anything, don't say anything. Just wait and see what I have gathered from that retreat. Don't worry about whether it's a high consciousness or not. Just wait and see. And over the weeks, I begin to realize that things that used to bother me didn't have the same sting to it anymore. That I don't know how to say it, but wisdom is not something you learn. It's not something you know. You know, but it's not something you learned. It's something that shifts our way of understanding whatever is in front of us. And I know, I feel this talk is a little bit more like spacey, but that is because I can't explain to you what wisdom is. I can only explain the context in which it shows up. But if you are going to find it or see it, it's going to arise in you completely different than it arises in me. So I started just paying attention to whatever I begin to notice in my life, just stuff that I begin to notice. I begin to notice that much of the things I got irritated at were really just me having something go my way, what I would call have to. Something has to be a certain way. That there was a have-to kind of energy with everything. And I started asking myself, does it really have to be that way? What if it didn't? I started noticing that there were certain things that upset me more than other things. If I thought something was unfair, I would get very upset, like almost like I gotta be a shiny knight in shining armor. I gotta fight him, whoever it is. I gotta fight for him because it felt unfair. But if I asked myself, "Is this really unfair, or am I just thinking it's unfair?" I start challenging some of these normal thoughts that I had. Instead of looking for ways to get more blissful, I just started looking for ways to see life more clearly. But what had happened, even if you take away the bliss, was that I was stiller. I was more concentrated. My mind, my capacity to stay with even unpleasant, undifficult situations was getting more and more and more real to me. Whatever insight came with me began to stay with me. Jack Kornfield once said that when wanting is filled, there comes a moment of satisfaction, not from the pleasure, but from stopping of the grasping. When I begin to stop trying to get my way, when I begin to stop trying to push away the stuff that I didn't like, in other words, get my way, something began to change. It didn't change that I didn't want my way. You know, I am a Virgo. I do want my way all the time. It didn't change that. What it changed was that I knew I just wanted my way. It's not like I all of a sudden had to have this because I was standing on some sense of self-righteousness that it has to be this way. It has to be like this because this is the right way. I just begin to know, oh, I just want my way. And when I knew I just want my way, I could let it go. Thich Nhat Hanh said once that enlightenment for a wave in the ocean is the moment the wave realizes it's water. Let me say it again. Enlightenment for a wave in the ocean is the moment the wave realizes it's water. I think I begin to see that this wisdom came more from realizing the truth of what was happening in any given moment. Not whether I was good or bad, right or wrong. That it came from just this capacity for me to be with whatever was arising. So I stopped this idea of trying to be kind and just noticed whether I was kind or not. I stopped trying to be generous and just notice whether I was generous. Did I feel generosity or did I feel a kind of attachment, pulling, tugging? That it really didn't matter to me anymore if I was a certain way, just that I was aware of whatever was arising in the moment. Which brings us to this third quality, this third sort of state of wisdom, which is discernment. Having practiced for as long as I have practiced, I believe that there is a natural state of kindness in all of us, this natural state of loving kindness, this natural state of generosity and compassion, that mostly that is the way we exist. And all of our conditioning in life gets in the way of that. It's the movement that moves. But if we were to be still long enough for all of the movement in our lives, all of the conditioning and all of the perpetual moving as human beings were to begin to settle and get as still as our bodies were, what would be there is kindness, generosity, and compassion. But that is not something we can make happen. It's more of a noticing that there's movement away from it. I begin to understand that my thinking mind could never understand this kindness. My thinking mind would never let me connect to a level of kindness that has nothing to do with whether or not somebody deserved my kindness. That the kindness would be given to everybody and anybody at will in my conduct. I don't think my thinking mind would ever accept generosity without some kind of limitations to it. I think the mere thought in my thinking mind that I would just give freely, that just does not make any sense. But many of us know that Buddha said, if you knew how important generosity was, you would not let a moment go by without giving everything you have. But to the mind, the idea of giving everything I have, well, we need some limitations, some boundaries on this. Foolishness. But Wisdom understands that level of generosity. Wisdom understands that. It understands how that exists, even in a world where the cost of living is stupid. Even in that world, wisdom understands generosity, understands kindness, and compassion. So, wisdom understands compassion and that I have the continuous capacity to be compassionate to all suffering. I could hold any and all suffering at will. The thinking mind does not have that capacity to understand that. So when we try to apply our thinking mind to learn how to be compassionate, to learn how to be generous, to learn how to be kind, it's not coming. I mean, it comes in a little kind of a fake way, but it's not. It's not the place that Buddha was talking about where we're going to have this great liberation. Another Pema Chodron quote is, what's encouraging about practice is that even if we shut down, we can no longer shut down in ignorance. We see very clearly that we're closing off. That in itself begins to illuminate the darkness of ignorance. So all of a sudden in this practice, that I'm trying to get to some state of blissfulness that I thought was the whole point. Instead, my conduct is getting kinder. My conduct is getting more generous. My heart is being more open, and I can care about tremendous amounts of grief. Even as a prosecutor, all my judgments about people who had committed crimes would show up. I mean, I could live in that world and I was fine because I'm a prosecutor, so we're the good guys. And I could find myself going into prison doing so many trainings. I had so many friends that would ask me, how can you do that? And it is compassion. I don't go into prison with any kind of judgment about who these people are. I could be a prosecutor and I could sit in a room full of people who had committed crimes, but in that room, we are all trying to awaken. It didn't matter what we were awakening from. We were still all trying to awaken. And everybody in that room's mind had the capacity to awaken. And for me, if everybody in that room was awakened, now that's the kind of world I wanted to live in. So why would I not go into a prison? Why would I not do this? So 10 years, almost every Saturday, I went into prisons and taught mindfulness and nonviolent communication for all these men and all these women. Big, huge classes because all these people wanted to have this capacity. That is not the thinking mind that can do that. And that is not the thinking mind that can tell me how to be that kind of a person. That is just that person showing up whenever that person shows up. I just waited for her to be there. Another phrase from Thich Nhat Hanh is people usually consider walking on water or in thin air a miracle. But I think the real miracle is not to walk either on water or in thin air, but to walk on earth. Every day we are encouraged Every day we are engaged in a miracle, which we don't even recognize. A blue sky, white clouds, green leaves, the curious eyes of a child, even our own eyes, all is a miracle. What I think wisdom does, if I were to try to put it into some kind of a contextual way to understand it, is to help us see the beauty in ordinary life. Help us see how magnificent ordinary life is. If you could see and spend the effort to try to connect with a moment of loneliness as a gift into the ways of yourself, this loneliness, you could see that as a gift. That's where wisdom is going to come from. It's not going to come from me giving you the secret cure on how you could not be lonely anymore. In fact, when you get to this place of wisdom, you don't even want to not be lonely anymore. You want to feel that and see what that is. What is that like? I have friends. I can be a little fanatical about this. You probably don't know that, but I have friends. They'll say, "Tori, so I want to talk to you, but I don't want to talk teacher-student. I just want to talk friend to friend." It really doesn't matter. Because as soon as I hear them say something like, "Something's going wrong," I am like, "What is that? Let's look at that. Let's get in there and see what's happening." You're so lucky. You have so much disappointment right now. Just think of the freedom that's in that. But that is the nature of this practice. So if we put all of this together, from faith all the way to where we are, that willingness to get into that disappointment and get a good look at it and see what's going on, you'll need some energy. So this, the mind is not going to want to see, the thinking mind is not going to want to see disappointment. It is going to want to get away from it. So constantly coming back to it, constantly coming back to this idea, is there really such a thing as disappointment? And if it is, what is it? Constantly coming back to wanting to see, wanting to understand, being still with it, with mindfulness and concentration, and waiting in that stillness for wisdom to arise out of it. It is a gift. The way these kind of relate to each other, the way all of the reading I've done, the way they all kind of relate to each other, is that you can think of mindfulness as kind of the base. It's like a scale, but it's not really a scale. It's just that the mindfulness is kind of our baseline place that we're going to try to look at this. And wisdom tempers our faith, because sometimes we can get so caught up in the belief of it that we're like off, you know? We put so much faith in teachers and talks and retreats and, oh, if I go on this retreat, then I'm going to have all this clearing and all of this stuff. We can put so much faith in it. Wisdom tempers that, keeps it in perspective. But at the same time, every time wisdom arises, it strengthens our faith to keep going, to keep trying, to keep looking at things that are difficult or things that we don't understand, to keep looking for that seed or that place of liberation. To do that practice, this constant looking, it takes some energy. And that energy arouses us, gives us the capacity to want to do this, but we need to temper that energy down a bit, kind of calm it down with concentration, allows that energy to kind of flow. But at the same time, concentration is empowered by energy. So there's this empowering energy that comes with us that's kind of tempered a little bit by concentration. And at the same time, that energy creates concentration. It allows us to stay focused on something. So this kind of balancing, blending together, we need them all to kind of blend in with each other. But ultimately, we're not the puppeteer. We're not orchestrating it. We are just trying to stay in the moment, in whatever is happening, with enough interest and curiosity to want to know what is really going on. We just want to stay right here, whatever this is. What is it that's going on? And have a bit of interest in it. We want to know ourselves. Know we are water. Know this. And what would it take for us to see? Buddha said, whoever sees the Dhamma sees me. And he who sees me sees the Dhamma. That's what we want to do. We want to see Buddha and see the Dhamma. Know the Dhamma, know Buddha. It's just this kind of not so much intellectually as we just want to be in this moment. Whatever's happening, where's the Dhamma in this? Where's Buddha in this? Where is that? How could I find him here, right now? So I want to leave you with Milarepa, because I don't know if you guys know the story of Milarepa, but he is my favorite teacher, because he messed up at the level that nobody, I never would mess up as much as he did. I mean, as angry a person as I am, I didn't kill as many people as he didn't kill, and I didn't cause near the destruction he caused. So if he, after doing all the damage he did, could liberate his mind, oh, I'll batten 1,000. So I think Milarepa is a good way to end this kind of, he had so much wisdom to me because he spent so long in caves with his mind, which was a tormented mind. And I came from such a difficult childhood that a lot of my natural inclination of the mind is to go to trauma and chaos and craziness. It doesn't always have to be that way. It's that way in my mind. It's not necessarily that way in your mind. But so when I have this connection with Milarepa, because he too came from all of this tormented mind and worked, spent hours working with that mind. But you'll have to find that teacher who speaks to the practice at the same level of where you're at. So let's just end with this. Maybe we'll sit and take a moment and put his words into silence and stillness. See demons as demons, that is the danger. Know they are powerless, that is the way. Understand them for what they are, that is deliverance. Realize them as your father and mother. That is their end. Realize that they are creations of the mind. They become its glory. And when these truths are known, all is liberated. Let me read it one more time, especially since I made a few mistakes. See demons as demons, that is the danger. Know that they are powerless, that is the way. Understand them for what they are, that is deliverance. Recognize them as your father and mother, that is their end. Realize that they are creations of the mind. They become its glory. When these truths are known, all is liberation. Okay, so thank you all very much for your practice. Next week, I will not be here. Linda was going to be here, even though I forgot what Linda was going to be teaching on. But she will be here next week. I'll take a couple of questions if you have it, but we do have a few announcements. See, I'm working on my patience, not saying anything. Oh, yeah. Excuse me? Oh, what the five faculties are? Faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. All right, good. There was another, yes, ma'am.
I'm wondering if this idea of being still in the moment of sort of upheaval when you're in it, if you have found a way to do that, or if it's more that the upheaval happens and then you find a moment of stillness to work on what that was. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Her question was whether or not you are still with upheaval when it's happening, or do you work on it after it's happened and in preparation for the next time? Is that pretty much? It's basically two things. One is, when I first started working with a lot of upheaval, it's not comfortable. I couldn't do it. I had too much anxiety around it in the first place. So the first sort of step is to begin to question why we're calling it upheaval in the first place, right? There's some wind going on, some movement going on here. So it's like inching up on it to get kind of comfortable with it in the first place. So some of that practice happens after the upheaval happens. So if I have a blow up at one of my kids or my sister or somebody, in that moment, in the beginning, I couldn't have caught it. It would be afterwards, it's so painful, I would begin to watch what happened. But there is another way to get this, the in round, which is almost like what I always tell people, it's almost like Mr. Miyagi in Karate Kid. Do it something over here. So when there's no upheaval, be still then. We practice being still over here. We have all these moments when we are not in really unpleasant circumstances, but we just enjoy those. We don't practice. So when there is a peace of mind, sit still. 5 minutes, 10 minutes, sit still, be still. There's no upheaval, be still. Because we think that we have to learn how to handle upheaval. And what I'm hoping we begin to see throughout the series is we don't have to learn how to hold upheaval. The mind can do that on its own. We have to learn how to give the mind, awaken that aspect of the mind to do that. And we awaken that aspect by having a willingness to practice, by putting some energy into that practice, being mindful, being still, allowing the mind to get concentrated, and then just waiting for that wisdom to arise. We do that over here as if nothing's happening. And then in the midst of upheaval, all of a sudden you're just like, oh, I'm not in the upheaval, but I know it's happening. I'm not in it though. That kind of awareness is not something you make happen. It's something that the mind can do on its own. But we don't practice, and then in the middle of upheaval, then we try to find the practice, like, oh, what can I do to get this? Practice over here when it's all nothing, boring, ordinary. It's just the breath. Really? I don't even have anything to work on. Don't worry about that. Practice there. Then when something happens, the mind will hold you in its own way. Do you see what I'm saying? That's what I'm hoping everybody leaves with this series. Not this sense that I have to somehow do this, but that you have to sort of just care enough about the mind to give it the capacity to awaken in its natural environment that it can on its own. And then wait for it to happen. Good. Okay. Thank you, guys. Good practice. And then we have Joyce with announcements.